In a previous edition of The Narrated Puritan, I talked about a book that was released in the year 1755 called Cases of Conscience. The very first question in this book on cases of conscience has to do with distinguishing between the workings of natural affection and the real exercise of grace in religious duties, also religious worship. And the reason I want to read this morning is because one of the things that I want to speak of next week when I address a number of the men at an association of Reformed Baptists is an application about the effects of contemporary worship within pure worship. This is a question that is very seldom asked in our day. When we add elements to the public worship of God, we have to ask ourselves, if the scriptures hasn't commanded them, what effect they may have upon the natural man and his feelings, and that which works upon the spiritual man in his worship of God. So again, the question is, how may we distinguish between the workings of natural affection and the real exercise of grace and religious duties? Quote, "The serious question recently came into my hands in these very words. Upon reading it, I could not help but see that it contained a query of the greatest importance, and therefore thought it might be very proper to take it into consideration and give it as clear a solution as lay in my power. I confess it is a very close and interested inquiry that requires some skill to answer it, but much more spiritual skill to apply it to our own hearts and cases. You will easily see both the importance and difficulty of the question by stating it in this free and familiar manner. There are many who go to or come from gospel ordinances entirely stupid, that means obdurate, careless and unaffected, having no real regard for the power or spirit of religion, and aiming at no more than the form of it. To such as these, the present query is an indifferent manner, and their very indifference is evident proof that the state of their persons or the frame of their hearts is really sad and deplorable, though they don't know it, or are utterly unconcerned about it. There are others who, when they attend upon or engage in religious duties such as reading, hearing, singing, and praying, have their affections strongly moved, so that these persons can and do frequently weep under ordinances for grief or joy. They often attend the means of grace with much pleasure in their countenances and many tears in their eyes. These appearances, I confess, are very pleasing and promising in an assembly, and sometimes they indicate that the Spirit of God is at work in their hearts. Many Christians are ready to take it for granted that those ordinances are truly beneficial where the passions are thus agitated, and where there is not the case to esteem those is lost opportunities. But here I must observe that we have great reason to be suspicious of ourselves, and we should not make this a rule by which to judge the usefulness of an ordinance. But let us make a further inquiry whether these motions within us, or these impressions upon us, are the workings of natural affection only, as they certainly may be, or are they the real exercise of spiritual grace? And this is a very question under consideration. Many, I fear, are awfully deceived with the mere workings of nature by thinking they are sufficient evidences of the presence and blessing of God in His own institutions, while on the other hand, many are groundlessly discouraged because they don't feel such strong emotions as others do, thinking that this is an evident token of the barrenness and uselessness of ordinances. That we may not be either deceived or unreasonably discouraged by these means, let me therefore now attempt a serious and plain solution for this query. Looking up to the Divine Spirit to make the whole clear to your understandings, and to apply it close to your consciences, I would offer the following considerations as preparatory to a direct answer, and then proceed to the solution itself. Observe, number one, that the affections of the mind may be excited in a merely natural way under divine ordinances. The proof of this point will be best introduced by endeavoring to set before you some of those ways in which mere nature may be impressed or raised under the means of grace. The affections of the mind may be excited by a natural impression. Thus, when a person is attending upon the ministrations of the word, he may find himself moved only by the beauty of the style, or the propriety of the language, or by the loudness or tone of the preacher's voice, or the apparent fervency of his address. Such circumstances as these may move the affections in a purely mechanical way, without being attended with any spiritual or saving effects. For by this only the animal nature is touched, or the speculative powers employed in a pleasing or disagreeable way. This seems to have been the case with the hearers of the great prophet Ezekiel, as mentioned in Ezekiel 33, verse 32. Indeed, to them you were like a very lovely song of someone who has a pleasant voice, and can play well on an instrument, for they hear your words, but don't do them. Let none therefore conclude that ordinances are profitable to them merely because they are pleasing and delightful to their ears, for the manner of the preacher's address may make a natural impression upon his hearers, without having any spiritual or useful effect. Number two, the affections may sometimes be raised by a natural sympathy, which regards not merely the manner of the preacher, but also the matter which he delivers. If the preacher himself appears very earnest in his address, and very much affected by what he delivers, this often effectually works on the natural affections of his hearers by way of sympathy. If he appears concerned, they feel a sympathetic concern along with him. If he seems raised and delighted, then by sympathy they partake of his pleasure, to such a degree as to actually weep and rejoice with him. Again, if the minister is setting forth something in expressive language that is very affecting in its own nature, then here the power of oratory produces in the minds of the hearers a sympathy with that which he is relating or describing. Thus, if the minister is setting forth in very mournful strains the sufferings and agonies of Christ, his relation of these tragic occurrences may move the affections of the people merely in a sympathetic way, without making any saving or spiritual impression on their hearts. And there may be no more in these workings of affection than what most persons, I believe, are obliged to feel when attentively reading that memorable history of Joseph and his brethren, by which the affections of joy and sorrow, resentment and pleasure are alternately excited in a way that is purely natural. Number three, the affections are sometimes raised under ordinances from a purely natural or notional inclination. A person may meet with something in a sermon which suits his taste, or falls in with his previous sentiments. It is natural for us to be pleased with, and fond of, our own opinions. And therefore, whenever we meet with what corresponds to them, we are necessarily pleased and delighted with it. If what is advanced in a sermon strongly confirms or beautifully illustrates what we believe, this will certainly draw forth a pleasure and agreeable affections of the mind. But let us not conclude from this that we have received any spiritual advantage, or that there has been anything more than a natural effect of a natural cause. For in all this satisfaction there may be nothing spiritual or evangelical, even though what we are pleased with is gospel truth. On the other hand, we may meet with something in a sermon that may disgust or displease us, and this may excite corresponding affections. We may be ready to esteem these affections as a true zeal for the truth, in opposition to error. Yet after all these emotions of the mind, there may be nothing spiritual or savory brought home to our hearts, nor any working of true grace in the soul. Once more, number four, whether the affections are raised more or less may very much depend upon our natural constitutions, for we know that some are of a softer, tenderer, and more affectionate disposition than others. And these are more easily touched and moved by what occurs in an ordinance than others, and they are more frequently melted into tears. Therefore, this must not always be ascribed to a greater degree of the Spirit's operations, since it may frequently be accounted for by a cause that is merely natural. Thus we see how natural impressions, natural sympathy, Natural inclination and natural constitution may be the sole cause or occasion of raising the affections under an ordinance. But, to prevent any discouraging mistake, let me proceed to observe in the second place that the affections being thus moved in a natural way is an experience that is no way evil in itself. There is no sin in this natural inclination, sympathy, or constitution. It is only right for us to be thus moved, unless these impressions lead us away from the gospel, or unless they are mistaken for the operations of saving grace. If indeed we fall into this mistake, it may have a very dangerous consequence, and it will be an awful means of making us misjudge our frames and experiences, being deluded by natural instead of spiritual impressions. This discourse is not designed to engage you to restrain or suppress such natural workings of the affections, since they are what the God of nature has formed in us, but it is only to teach us how to distinguish them from what is truly spiritual and saving, so that we might not mistake nature for grace. For this reason, I would further observe, in the third place, that the workings of natural affection may be a means in the hands of the divine spirit to excite and promote the exercise of spiritual grace. God may bless a natural constitution or sympathy and make it a means of spiritual good. Many a person, by the means of his natural affections, has been brought and kept under the ministration of the gospel with delight, and this has been the first occasion of his being begotten through the gospel. Many have been so captivated by the fervency or oratory of a gospel minister as to introduce them into privileges which have been blessed to everlasting advantage. Remember the case of Ruth the Moabitess. Though raised in idolatry, the strong affection that she had for her mother-in-law Naomi induced her to come into the land of Israel with her mother, and in a sweet, gradual, and insensible way she was prevailed upon to forsake her false gods, and to put her trust in the shadow of the wings of the God of Israel. How beautifully her natural and spiritual affection united in these words, "Your people shall be my people, and your God my God," Ruth 1 verse 16. As many are caught to their ruin by those things which lay hold of their natural affections at first, so, blessed be God, some are brought to Christ in the very same way. Once more, it is needful to take notice, in the fourth place, that the exercise of saving grace and ordinances frequently stirs up our natural affections into sensible exercise. Grace working strongly in the heart has an effect upon the animal frame. The emotions of the soul by the influence of the divine spirit will occasion and produce a great change in the posture of the animal spirits, so that the case is mutual. Natural affection may be so blessed as to be an occasion of our receiving spiritual grace and comfort, while on the contrary, the exercise of saving grace may be the occasion of many impressions upon our animal frames. But though the things are thus frequently linked together and cooperate with one another, yet there still is a most important distinction between them. This, therefore, brings me to collect the whole together, in order to give a direct solution to the question proposed. What has been said will alter the form of the query a little. For since natural and spiritual affection are so connected, the question is not whether our natural affections are moved, or only our spiritual affections are excited in ordinances, but how will we know whether there is anything more than what is purely natural in the motions of our affections under divine ordinances? There may be, and generally is, a great deal of what is natural along with that what is spiritual and saving. And there may be nothing of what is spiritual and saving where there is much of that which is natural. In order to distinguish things that differ in this case, let us put the following queries seriously to ourselves. 1. Whether that which moves our affections under an ordinance is what is truly spiritual and evangelical. Sometimes we are affected by the oratory of the language, the tone of the voice, or the suitableness of the phraseology. And if this is all, certainly nothing but nature is here. Sometimes we are affected by the manner delivered, as well as by the manner of the delivery. But perhaps what touches and moves us is a mere superficial or historical part of the discourse, without being at all moved by the interesting, important, and spiritual part of it. In this case, nothing but natural sympathy is here. It is like the daughters of Jerusalem in Luke 23, verses 27 to 28, who behold the sufferings of Christ with tears of compassion, without seeing or being impressed by the spiritual end of his sufferings, or attending to the awful consequences of them upon the city and its inhabitants. But if our affections are worked on in a spiritual manner, it is by our regard to the evangelical parts of the discourse. 4. So far as true grace works, what chiefly affects the mind are those things which respect the method of grace, the salvation of the soul, the suitableness and excellence of Christ, and the like. And if we are made to feel the power of these things upon our mind so as to be impressed by the thought of the sinfulness of sin, the fullness of the covenant of grace, the riches of grace, and the way of the Spirit in convincing, converting, sanctifying, and comforting the soul, something more than nature is here now, because nature will never teach us to regard such spiritual things in a spiritual way. 2. We should inquire not only whether our affections are moved, but likewise whether our very hearts and consciences are touched. There is a vast difference between the affections and conscience and subjects of this nature, and it is of the highest importance for us to discern this difference, because unless the conscience is impressed, although their motions and impressions are of no saving avail, let us therefore ask ourselves whether we see and feel our own concern in a word delivered, and whether the thought of its respecting our own state, frame, or duty is that which makes a word pleasant or powerful to us. To familiarize this manner to us, let us be concerned to bring it home to our souls in particular cases. When we are hearing or thinking about the doctrine of the depravity of nature, does this affect us in a humbling way, because we see and feel it is our own case? When we are attending to the doctrine of Christ and his redemption, atonement, and righteousness, what is it now that affects our minds? Is it merely because we like the doctrine and are pleased with the manner of handling it? Or is it because these important truths are applied to our consciences as the only ground of our hope and a proper manner of consolation for our souls under a real sense of the sinfulness of guilt and sin? When the nature and necessity of the Spirit's gracious and powerful influences are displayed so as to affect us, it is only because we like the subject, the preacher, or his manner? Or is it because we have in our own souls at that time a sight and feeling of our need of them, and because we hope and desire to be made partakers of them? Once more, when we hear a searching discourse, a discourse that plainly sets forth the marks and signs of a safe or dangerous state, of a good or bad spiritual frame, let us then observe if this touches our affection. If it does, is the reason because we are led by it to a serious examination of our own heart, state, and frame, and have our hopes or our fears excited upon this principle? Thus, in all cases, inquire whether what affects us in reading or hearing the word is a sight we have of our own concern with or interest in the things declared. If so, this is in effect, it is more than natural, because nature of itself will never thus apply the word to our own heart and conscience. And we may be sure that a very great point is gained by the word and ordinances of the gospel if they come close to our own state or frame in this way. On the other hand, it is to be feared that many are pleased with and some way impressed by the word, but are never in this way touched to the quick by it. 3. Let us inquire whether our heart is so impressed as to stir up the graces of the Spirit into exercise in our soul. This can never be done without such an application of the word to the conscience as has been just described. And where there is this self-application, it seldom fails to quicken and excite these graces. But so far is it possible for the word to be misapplied, so as to promote a false hope or beget an awful despair, it is therefore necessary to add this question to the former. Did the declarations of the Word humble us under a sense of our own littleness, unworthiness, guilt, and pollution? By the Word, are we emptied of self and made to abhor ourselves because of our defilement and abominations? Are our desires raised for Christ, His sanctifying grace, and His justifying righteousness? Are we hereby stirred to flee to Christ, to depend upon Him, to seek conformity to Him, and to love Him as one who is altogether lovely? In a word, by the means of grace, are we drawn away from self, sense, and sin, to Jesus Christ for righteousness and strength? If motions such as these are produced or excited in our hearts, in reading, hearing, or prayer, then it is evident that the graces of the Spirit are exercised. And even though it is under an ordinance, where such experiences are felt, there may be much of natural sympathy or impression, yet we have no reason to question the operations of grace merely because these are the workings of nature, but rather we should bless God that He is pleased to turn the natural affections to a spiritual channel, or to make them a means of promoting what is truly spiritual and evangelical. But in order to prevent all mistakes on this topic, that we might not be deceived with counterfeit for real graces, it will be necessary to make one more inquiry. Number 4. Whether these motions of affections have any holy tendency and produce a holy effect on our hearts and lives. These workings of soul under ordinances, however strong they may be, however pleasant or evangelical in appearance, are certainly delusive if they don't have the stamp of holiness upon them. If these pleasing impressions tend to make us less watchful against sin, or less careful to perform our duty, if they fill us with a pleasing imagination that we need not be so afraid of sinning, or need not be so diligent in duty because all is safe, then turn of thought included in these motions of affection is an infallible mark that the experience is delusive, detrimental, and diabolical. But if these workings of soul tend to increase our hatred of sin and our watchfulness against it, and to promote our love for Christ and true holiness, if they leave such a savor behind them upon our spirits that it embitters sin and gives us a relish for and delight in the ways of the Lord, if they promote our reverence for God's name and our love for His people, His ordinances, and His precepts, we may be certain that they are of a spiritual and saving nature. Let us now collect a whole together and apply by a few remarks for instruction and examination. 1. From this we learn that there is no grace of the Spirit that does not have its counterfeit. Nature can mimic a true faith by a notional belief, a true hope by presuming on the enjoyment of gospel privileges, a true love by a false love for the means of grace built on natural principles, a true godly sorrow by a sympathetic weeping under an affecting discourse, and a true joy in the Lord by a delight in gospel ordinances based on self-righteous and carnal principles. Number 2. From this we learn that judging the degree of our profiting under an ordinance by the degree of our affections is a deceitful way of judging. We may be most profited when least affected, and least profited when most affected. For it is not the degree, but the nature and kind of the impression that we are to attend to when examining whether the Word is profitable to us or not. This thought, if properly regarded, will afford manner for the conviction of some, and for the consolation of others. Are you often delighted with and melted into tears under an ordinance? Don't immediately conclude that you are a thriving Christian. For most, if not the whole of this experience, may arise only from a natural softness of temper, or from the natural impressions made on you by the liveliness of the preacher, or the beauty of his style. On the contrary, are you seldom affected in a lively manner, or to any sensible degree under an ordinance? Do not therefore at once discourage yourself, for notwithstanding this defect, you may have a solid love for Christ, a hatred of sin, and a desire for holiness promoted and confirmed, And if this is your case, you are not a forgetful hearer, but a doer of the work, even though you may not be so affectionate as some others are. Number 3. From this, learn how to put proper questions to yourselves to know whether you are truly advantaged by any divine ordinances. When you reflect back upon any means of grace you have enjoyed, or upon any spiritual duties you have performed, converse with your souls in some manner such as this. My soul, you have now been engaged in a precious duty, enjoying a spiritual privilege. But how has it been with me under it? Have I been totally obdurate, or have I not been in some measure affected, impressed, or delighted? If I have been absolutely unaffected in hearing prayer and so on, then surely I have great reason to be humbled and ashamed that my heart has been so hard and the powers of my soul so sadly wandering, or so inactive and unemployed when things of infinite importance have been transacting. But if I have been melted, pleased, or impressed, don't I have some reason to still be jealous over myself, lest what has passed in my soul should be what is merely natural instead of being truly spiritual? Let me then come to a close and serious examination. What was it that made me weep or rejoice? That pleased me or impressed me? Did those glorious truths that were delivered in preaching, or those important concerns that I transacted with God in prayer, affect my mind? Was I enabled under the ordinance to apply these things to my own case? Was I affected with my own interest in them, or my concern with them? And did these impressions stir me to go outside of myself and cast my soul upon Christ for righteousness? Were my affections of hope or fear, of joy or sorrow, so excited as to draw me away from self and sin to Christ and His grace? Indeed, these experiences have anything of a holy stamp upon them. Have they left a savor behind them that make me more desirous after Christ and holiness, and to be delivered from the power, pollution, and practice of sin? If this is my case, then I have great cause to bless God for the presence of His grace and the influence of His Spirit. And so far as I find my experience defective in these particulars, so far I am called upon to humble myself before God for the barrenness and unfruitfulness of my heart in these spiritual duties. Thus, on the whole, we may see how to distinguish between the workings of natural affection and the exercise of spiritual grace. But let me entreat you to be earnest for the teachings of the Holy Spirit, which are absolutely necessary to apply what has been stated to your own heart, and to enable you to pass a right judgment for yourself in a case so spiritual and so important.